My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tries to test their respective vocabularies. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following words? Beginning with Frank Muir. Frank, a glitch. G-L-I-T-C-H.
What's a good word, isn't it? Yes. A lovely word. Glitch. I would have thought... It could be many things, Jack. I would have thought it's a boil on a horse. Has that sort of feeling.
Yes, it's a bit more mechanical than a horse.
Ah, a glitch. I know, it's those black bits you find floating on your coffee in industrial areas. A glitch.
That's terribly sort of...
Or could it be?
No.
How long do you want me to go on this?
Stop, you've lost.
I'm going to give you half a mark for ingenuity.
What do you think?
It's a fairly new word. It's in Chambers's dictionary. I don't know if it's in any other. That's used by space technicians in America for a defect in a rocket, either in the space capsule end of it or its propulsive mechanism. It can be something quite small, a minute change in voltage, which they don't like much, and they call that a glitch. Half a mark.
I think the G-L-I-T-C-H spells out, it's one of those words which has a good little instrument to confuse Houston.
I'm going to advance Frank Muir from half a mark to 1 mark for that one.
I thank you.
On to Anne Scott James. Anne, your word is picaresque.
Well, you always hear it applied to novels, so I don't see why it shouldn't be applied to other forms of literature. A picaresque novel is a novel which is all about rogues and... And rogues, in fact.
Yes.
And vagabonds.
Yes. Do you remember where it comes from?
Well, I know it's a Spanish word, not a French one, which you might think, but I'm afraid I don't know what it is.
That's good enough. Yes, absolutely right, Anne. That's 2 marks. It's relating to rogues or knaves, and it was specially applied to the kind of novels that they were writing in Spanish in the 17th century about their adventures. And I suppose the nearest thing in English is, well, either Humphrey Clinker or possibly Tom Jones, where there are a fair number of rogues about. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, funicular, with an R on the end.
Oh, not as funiculi.
No, not that one.
I always thought that was like a legal expression. The funicular will pay to the funiculi, active in the past. It's a sort of overhead railway. It's up in... You could say that cable car is the vernacular for funicular.
Yep. Yes, and it's something to do with a cord or rope or cable. That's what it means literally. It's a diminutive of the Latin word for a rope. But then it is, as Dennis quite right says, used as a noun for a cable railway, particularly the kind of cable railway in which it saves itself trouble because the car which is running downhill pulls up the car which is full of passengers. That's what... a funicular railway literally is. Dennis Power, your word is a scintilla. S-C-I-N-T-I-L-L-A.
Something rather small.
Very small.
Very small. A tiny bit, a spark.
Yes, that'll do. And metaphorically?
Metaphorically? Oh, a tiny fragment of wit or, I mean, the kind of things which you throw away all the time, Jack.
That's very complimentary. Yes, I'm not going to mark you because it's complimentary. the usual figurative phrase is not a scintilla of evidence. That is not a spark, not the faintest bit of light of evidence at all. But literally, you're quite right, it's a minute particle, a spark or sparklet of light. 2 marks. Well, maybe people who like to guess ahead at the stories at the end of the program. So I'm going to ask Frank now what your quotation is going to be for later on in the program.
My quotation, Jack, and if listeners have pencil and paper, now's the time to take it down, is
The game is not worth the candle.
And yours, Dennis?
Well, if the listeners still have pencil and paper, I should make out the shopping list or something. Because mine is, I think, therefore I am.
Well, thank you. That brings us on to round two, which is a round of alleged national characteristics. Fairly sweeping generalizations that have been made about nations or nationalities. For 2 marks, who said or wrote the following? Frank Muir. The French are wiser than they seem, and the Spaniards seem wiser than they are.
One never praised the French unless one was at peace with the French, which was fairly rare, wasn't it, in our history. So it's not 18th or 19th century.
No, it's earlier, you're quite right.
So if it's earlier, and we're praising the French and disliking the Spaniards, presumably... It's not the Bard.
Most people... No, not the Bard, but a lot of... Somebody whom they thought the Bard was written by.
Oh, Bacon. Yes.
Bacon, yes, all right.
Sir Francis Bacon.
Yes, 1.5. I helped rather considerably there. It's Francis
Philosopher
Bacon...
Philosopher and...
Yes, statesman, yes. Francis Bacon's essay on Of Seeming Wise. 1.5. And Scott James. The Irish are a fair people... They never speak well of one another.
That could be almost anybody. Let's try Sidney Smith before we do a little of Frank's deduction. Any good?
Earlier contemporary.
Could it be Dr. Johnson?
It could.
Oh.
Well, yes, you get your two. I didn't help much there. It's quoted by Boswell. It's a letter which Sam Johnson wrote to Dr. Barnard, the Bishop of Killaloe. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. The English belong to a class of human beings with whom you can talk only after you have first knocked out their teeth.
I think it's neither witty nor very apt. I can't think who it can be. They're obviously no great friend of ours.
No, very definitely not.
Are we back to the French?
No, I should cross the Rhine.
Oh, it's a German.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, well...
What, Bismarck.
No, later.
Oh, in the last war?
Yes.
Albert Herring.
Yeah. I don't know, it could be any of that lot. Any of the chapter of fire? Was it one of the Nazis?
Yes, it was. And one who spoke a lot.
Goebbels.
Yes. Goebbels.
Dr. Goebbels. I think you get there. That was a bit of ingenious work. Dr. Goebbels from a speech around 1940. Joseph Powell. Let it be clearly understood that the Russian is a delightful person till he tucks in his shirt.
Said by an Englishman?
Yes.
Said by an Englishman. A politician?
No.
Not a politician,
it's
right.
Fairly sort of elitist,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
A novelist?
Yes.
A novelist.
Short story writer, it's more than novelist.
Oh, short story writer, no. No, who wrote short stories? Hardy, no.
Yes, but no.
No. Look, we must go on for a bit. Come along.
Yes, they tended to come across the passes, the Russians, who didn't look out.
Kipling.
Yes, that's what I wanted. Yes, I think.
Kipling.
Historian Rudyard Kipling's Life's Handicap, The Man Who Was. It's a rather strange and pathetic story. Well, now we have a round of origins and derivations. For 2 marks, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they derive? Frank Muir, plimsolls. I mean the shoes.
Well, they're a kind of light canvas footwear. And they took their name from Samuel Plimsolls.
Yes.
Who was an MP for Derby.
Yes.
Who finally broke up this terrible business of ships sinking because they're filled with too much cargo by insisting that a mark be made on the side beyond which a ship could not be laden. And the shoes are named after him. Now, why is the interesting thing, isn't it? Is it because they're used on deck of a ship, or is it because they... Due to their construction, they have a kind of line running around them.
That's right. It was a Liverpool shoe manufacturer with a bright idea who invented these shoes and said they would keep you dry at any rate, up to the waterline, which is where the rubber stopped and the canvas, or the material began. No, not very. No, as I said. Well earned, 2 marks. Anne Scott James, a halibut.
What is a halibut?
Origin. The Dutch for it is heil boot.
Oh, how's your Dutch, Dennis? You're not helping me today.
Boot.
Boot. Boot.
Boots. Now, what's a halibut look like? It's sort of
flat.
Flattish, isn't it? I mean, it's a flat boot. Oh, it's a kind of plimsoll. It's a this is the boot fetishist to set this round.
Not a dover sole, but a plimsoll.
Heil boot. Kind of...
The other...
Go on. Do something with this.
The other way...
He called it that. Mm. Some chap found it, and he said, what do we call it? And he said, so let's call it a halibut. So why do I just for the halibut?
If you if you look in the dictionary, you'll find it spelled another way sometimes, which is H-O-L-I-B-U-T.
Well, then I think it was discovered by my friend on the holy day, and Christmas, in fact, which was unusual time to be finding fish, but it was. It means a holy fish.
It means a holy fish, but why?
Ah, eaten on Good Friday.
Good enough. Well, you fought your way to a conclusion. I can't give you a whole lot, but it's 1.5. It's holy plus butt. Butt means a fat fish, rather like a flounder. It comes from a Dutch word. And the holy part refers to the fact that the fish was frequently eaten on holy days in which you were forbidden to eat any meat. So, holy butt, halibut. Dennis Norden, all according to Cocker.
Well, that means all carried out as per instructions.
Yes.
And Cocker was, I don't know, he was obviously an expert or an authority on something.
He was an authority, but can you...
Yes, he was an authority on doodle-doo.
No, it's not quite, but...
Isn't Dickensian, is it?
No, he's in the same line of business as Einstein.
Oh, is he? Taylor.
Difficult.
No, he was a relativity discoverer.
Yes, but...
Or a mathematician.
That's what I wanted. Yeah. Again, I think 1.5. It means in accordance with strict rule calculations, and it came as a phrase in the 18th century after Edward Cocker had published a very precise book of mathematical rules. I think it comes, quite rightly, you suggested, Dennis, but a bit earlier, into a play, into a farce, written by a chap called Murphy, called The Apprentice, in 1756. Dennis Powell, a dandelion.
A dandelion is a flower.
Yes.
Yellow.
Yes.
Common. Grows in most parts of Europe. Has a great number of petals and green sepals, and a serrated leaf, and it comes from the French dandelion, meaning tooth of a lion.
Absolutely right. You can't fault that at all. 2 marks. Well,
if everybody answered like that, we'd get a lot more productivity on these, on these panel programs.
I've written down, incidentally, as a help, Dinde de Lion, turkey of lion. But
and now we come to the last round, and to Dennis and Frank's quotations. And the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, your quotation, which is, I think, a familiar proverb, the game is not worth the candle. I think it's a proverb that comes in most languages.
Yes, a very true proverb, actually. When you earn your living as a writer, this proverb soon sort of bears itself strongly upon your thinking. In fact, there is the ways to make money out of writing are to write algebra books, cookery books, or light love. My scheme, and I think this is a pretty good idea, is to do a kind of female version of Tom Jones. And my heroine is called, not Tom, but Lavinia. And whereas the father, or the foster father of Tom Jones, was called Squire Allworthy, my country bumpkin, Squire, is a bit of a nutcase, so he's called Squire Nutworthy. And he spends his time doing things like trying to cross a pointer with a hound so that when they lose the fox, that the hounds can at least sort of indicate in which direction it's gone. And His wife is a country body in a mop cap, Mistress Allworthy, who is one of these sort of kitchen fanatics and is always bizzing around with a body like a cottage loaf, or cottage, anyway. And she's always working around the kitchen and saying things like, come in, my dear, I've just swept the chimney and I'm just going to... I'll swept the chimney and I'm just going to put up some pickled onions. And, you know, if she wants to get something out of her top shelf, she just runs up a batch of bread. Well, it's that kind of household, the Squire and Utterworthy, in which Lavinia is grows up. And she's a strange sort of boyish and yet secretive child. Very interesting character, I know. And she spends a lot of her time just alone in the in a sort of tiny little room in the house, so they call her Lavi. And this behaviour worries Squire Nutworthy. He says she be privy to our family discussions, you know. And she won't come. And then Lavi grows older. She begins to get a little worried about living in this dreadful house in the Shires, because she yearns, as all girls do, for the bright lights of the ton in London and society and meeting some nobleman and this dreadful farm she lives in with the squire and his mistress. There isn't much chance. Lavinia goes up to London and she meets the one who is a friend of the Prince Regent, Beau Brummel, and she met the famous diarist, Beau Peeps, and she... and she met the famous wastrel, Beau Nidal. And then one night, her fortune was made. She was at Almack's, at a rout. She was introduced to the third Marquess of Kendal, who was aged 102. And the old Marquess of Kendal made a lot of money in the American colonies. And he fell in love with a Lavinia on sight, this young girl, shimmering in all her proud beauty, and he fell for her instantly and said, marry me, and I marry me, madame, and you'll have my fortune. And she said, put that in writing. So he called for a footman and a bottle of ink, and he dipped the footman in the bottle of ink, and he wrote, Lavinia, if she takes my name, she takes me fortune. Whereupon she said, I am yours. And she ripped the thin silk apart and exposed two totally bare ankles. Naturally, the old boy went pop. He went, whop, whop, and sort of exploded. So he was dead, and she hang on, there's miles more. So she took her slip of paper to a notary, and she added his name by deed poll to hers. She hyphenated, so she added his name to the end of hers, which meant that she collected all his money. Well, that's my plot. It's pretty good, isn't it? And I've got the perfect name for it. I think you'll agree. It just is her name, the name she adopted after her deed poll, and in fact, which she was known by in the society of the 1920s. And it's a good title, too, because it has a kind of proverbial flavour. I shall call it The Gay Miss Nutworthy Kendal.
Well, that seemed to me Fielding heavily crossed with Ian Fleming, but we'll go on to Dennis Norden. And if we remember, his quotation was from Descartes, I think, therefore, I am.
Well, although I think, therefore, I am is the line on which Descartes rose to stardom, the truth of the matter is, it's not what he actually wrote. So I can't tell you how warmly I welcome this opportunity of explaining the correct version, if only for poor Rini's sake. Rini being, as you know, the unfortunate Christian name of this eminent 17th century philosopher. And even though the French pronounce it René, It was still one hell of a liability for a chap in those rough times. And the other liability that poor Descartes laboured under was he had this real drag of a wife. Now, although Madame Descartes brought a bit of lolly to the match, the truth is that she was very bourgeois, several years older, and inclined to be bossy. So that every time Descartes sat down to dream up a crystalline aphorism or an eternal verity, in she'd come with her curlers in and try and dust the ornaments. Or she'd say, "I'm sorry, I need this room for a social occasion. You'll just have to take your philosophy set out into the shed." In fact, it's hard to think of a way in which she wasn't a dead loss to an aspiring philosopher, because even where their more intimate relationships were concerned, every time he tried to make love to her, her only response was the phrase which George Gershwin was later to make use of: "Descartes, take that away from me." So under such miserable working conditions, you may wonder, how did Descartes manage to become number one on the among the philosophy chart toppers? But as I've indicated, it was all due to the widespread misunderstanding about the line, "I think, therefore I am." And to trace the origin of that, I must take you back through the magic of radio to the big New Year's Eve party that Madame Descartes gave for the local gentry to celebrate the advent of 1636. Because what she decided, you see, was that it wouldn't be a formal affair. What they'd have would be a buffet. That, as you know, is a French word meaning we've got more people than we've got chairs. And what's more, as it was to be a very late do, with the guests not arriving till around 11 o'clock, Madame ran up an enormous batch of that French version of bacon and egg flan they call quiche. Madame Descartes said to Rini, she said, "I'll put all the quiche out on the sideboard, but what I don't want is people helping themselves all through the evening and treading a whole lot of crumbs into the aubergine. So I am relying on you to see that nobody starts digging in till an hour after we've seen the new year in, when they can all take plates and eat properly, you see." So there you have the situation. The founder of the Cartesian school of philosophy relegated to the position of securicor for bacon and egg flan. Well, as he said to Father Dinet, a Jesuit priest who was about his only friend at that time, as he said to him, "This is not really doing my career any good at all. Being stationed at the sideboard till 1 o'clock in the morning, I'll be a limp rag tomorrow, and that'll be another day with no philosophy done." So the good father said, "Well, look, Reen," he said, "why don't you use this as working time? Take a pen and a paper serviette, and while you're sitting here, just ad lib a few lofty thoughts and jot them down." And Descartes said, "That is not a bad idea. Give us a lend of your quill." So for the next hour or so, there by the sideboard, the two friends sat, and Descartes was just scribbling out a few zingers about corporeal rationality and adventitious volition, when suddenly he looked up, and to his horror, he saw Father Dinet had absent-mindedly helped himself to a quiche and was quietly munching it. Well, Descartes was just about to say, "Hey, watch it, watch it. They're not supposed to be eaten yet." when he noticed something else. There, not 2 meters away, and within earshot, stood his wife. So thinking very fast, he took another paper serviette and wrote the message down on it, and then he furtively shoved the serviette under Father Dine's nose. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was the point where this 300-year-old misunderstanding originated. Because that line, which Father Dine later published to the world as, "I think, therefore I am," what it in fact referred to was the time ban on the bacon and egg flans. You see, what Descartes actually wrote was, "I think there for 1 a.m.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Dennis Norden wins the story, and he and Anne Scott-James also win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.